I want to welcome you to the session entitled From Seed to Flower, Growing HIA Practice Using the Minnesota Example. In Minnesota, city and county agencies, community organizations, and university partners have carried out health impact assessments, or HIAs, to inform decisions at the city and county level with health in mind. And through these efforts, they've helped develop and seed further activity in the state. This session will discuss the activities taking place throughout the state, the role of local and national funding partners to support the growth of HIA activity there, and how this model could be expanded to other regions or states. I'm a senior associate with the Health Impact Project, which is a collaboration of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trusts. I'm based at Pew in Washington, D.C., and there I support health impact assessment demonstration projects and what we're calling program grants, which are designed to build systems and infrastructure to support consideration of health on a more routine basis. I should say, in your program, the moderator for this session was originally Katie Hirono, my colleague at the Health Impact Project, who has since moved to Australia. So I just want to thank her from very afar for her work in coordinating this session with me. I'm delighted to be here with three HIA practitioners and colleagues. To my right is Kristen Robb, who is the director of the Minnesota Climate and Health Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. She's provided HIA trainings and technical assistance to a number of organizations in Minnesota as well as outside the state. And she's interested in creating healthier environments that incorporate climate change through health impact assessment, good design, and policy change. Jonathan Heller, to her right, is the co-founder and co-director at Human Impact Partners. He also has worked on numerous HIAs and has provided organizations around the country with training and technical assistance for HIA. Doran Trance is the executive director of Isaiah, a faith-based nonprofit organization, and it's a partnership of 100 congregations throughout the state of Minnesota that advocate for racial and economic equality. It's really a pleasure to be presenting with all of you today. During today's session, which runs for an hour and a half, we'll each be giving about a 15-minute presentation, and then we should have plenty of time, if I do a good job keeping us on track, for questions and discussion at the end. So before I jump into my presentation about our work in Minnesota, I just wanted to get a sense of people's familiarity with health impact assessment in the room today. So if you don't know what HIA is, or maybe have heard of it but don't know much about it, raise your hand. Great. We'll tell you a little bit in a minute. How many people in the room have maybe attended another presentation or a training? Wonderful. That's a lot of hands. And how many of you are either conducting a health impact assessment or have conducted one in the past? Wonderful. So you can answer all our questions at the end. So for the couple of hands that are less familiar with HIA, here is the definition from the National Research Council that put out guidance on HIA in 2011. I'll just quickly read it here. HIA is a structured process that uses scientific data, professional expertise, and stakeholder input to identify and evaluate public health consequences of proposals and suggest actions that could be taken to minimize adverse health impacts and optimize beneficial ones. That is a mouthful, but here is another way to say it. HIA asks how a proposed project, plan, or policy, and a key word here is proposed, affects the social determinants of health, like housing, transportation, education, access to parks and natural spaces, or access to healthy foods, and then in turn, how that can potentially lead to changes in health outcomes. Here's a little bit more beyond that formal definition. We really see the value in HIA in that it provides a framework for community capacity building and empowerment, that it can bring together a broad range of impacted people, including business, community members and organizations, as well as elected officials, et cetera. It's an effective tool for meaningful cross-sector collaboration. It can provide a forum for public health professionals and planners, for example, to have a conversation about how to find that common language in their work and how to work towards similar goals. HIA addresses health inequity. One way it does this is by looking at how impacts of a policy might be distributed across a population for that proposed policy or project. and increases transparency, supports inclusiveness, democracy, and again, community engagement in the policymaking process. And if for those of you newer to HIA, you know, I think all of us would be happy to refer you to more resources to learn more. So please come talk with us at the end. So I'm now going to jump into talking about the Health Impact Project's work in HIA and what we've seen as different strategies and models to build HIA capacity and practice in the state of Minnesota, and how we worked with new partners to support practice there. And I have no relationships to disclose. So like I mentioned, the Health Impact Project is a collaboration of RWJF and Pew. We're a national initiative to support HIA practice in the United States. And we do this by funding HIAs along with technical assistance and training and mentorship. We partner with national networks like the National Association of County and City Health Officials and the National Network of Public Health Institutes to use those existing infrastructures to teach, increase awareness about HIA and conduct HIA. We also work with many others to host the national HIA meeting, which just took place in September. There will be another one in about 18 months. And we're also working on completing two federal-level health impact assessments. So many of you may have seen this map before if you've been to other HIA presentations, but as we work to support the field in the U.S., what does it look like? So in 2007, we knew of about 27 HIAs, and now we have, as far as we know, almost 300 completed or in-progress HIAs. And since 2007, we've seen this map pretty quickly fill in, and now have quite a large library of practice, especially along the West Coast, but also in places like Georgia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. So zooming in on Minnesota, here is a map showing that there are currently 18 completed or in progress HIAs in the state. My suspicion is that there are actually more than that, because usually, there's no formal process to track HIA activity unless we hear about it and then put it on our map. And Kristen will be talking much more in a few minutes about practice and the evolution of practice in the state. But just to quickly say, you know, as you can see here, most of the practice has focused in the Twin Cities area, well, not all, and has also primarily been focused on built environment, transportation, and land use decisions. So our work in Minnesota at the Health Impact Project started in 2009 through our national call for proposals when we funded ISAIAH to conduct an HIA on light rail zoning. And between our first national call for proposals and our second, a partnership with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota Foundation arose through conversations with a senior program officer there. She had heard of HIA and was interested in how this could be used as a tool to address those upstream determinants of health and health equity. And we saw this new partnership as a way to help local funders broaden their funding portfolio and to support effective HIAs by bringing them into a network of technical assistance providers and other HIA practitioners to connect them with things like the national and grantee meeting so that as new groups do this, they're not going it alone. We also saw this as a way to focus capacity building on a local level, partnering with a local funder to make sure that we were reaching the right organizations, getting the word out about the funding opportunity as much as possible. So Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota Foundation gave a grant to the Health Impact Project to then manage a call for proposals process and coordinate work with our technical assistance providers and connect them with resources. And building off of that model, we've worked with four other foundations in somewhat similar ways. So across three call for proposals, Blue Cross and Blue Shield has funded seven HIAs in the state. And after the second round of funding, we heard from organizations that there was a need and interest in learning more about what HIA was and feeling more prepared to submit an application on a new activity. We didn't get as big of a response as we expected in the second round of funding, and through conversations with applicants and others, we identified that the reason wasn't necessarily a lack of interest, but really that there was a need for training. We also learned that organizations newer to HIA were hesitant to invest a lot of resources in a very long grant application, and so we modified and actually went back to our original system, which was a two-step funding process, so that people could fill out a short application and then hopefully be invited for a full proposal, and then at that point invest more resources in the opportunity. So to address that need, we developed a training model to help Minnesota organizations feel more equipped to identify potential HIA topics and apply for the grant opportunity. And we contracted with a technical assistance provider, the Georgia Health Policy Center, a public health institute, to host two trainings outside of the Twin Cities area and provide limited technical assistance in preparation for that training. This funding model supported, that I'm talking about, supported those last four HIAs, and the ones italicized on the bottom attended those trainings and then submitted an application. The application to attend the training included screening questions, which essentially propose an HIA topic. And then we had, with our technical assistance providers, one-on-one phone calls to go over that identified topic so that everyone came to the training with a potential idea, either to submit for funding or just to move forward in their organization. We had a one-and-a-half-day training, which included a pretty typical health impact assessment training, walking through the steps of HIA, and then the second half day was really focused on one-on-one activity with each of the project teams attending the training to either work on next steps if they had already successfully screened an HIA topic, or to go back to the drawing board with them and think through potential other topics. And then following that training, we also had another TA call in case there were any follow-up questions, and then after that had a funding deadline. So from that training model, we reached about 100 people on that pre-training webinar, and then about 40 people. There were two snowstorms when we did these trainings. About 40 people at the in-person trainings. So those training and funding opportunities were really just one piece contributing to practice in the state and helping to build momentum. But it's really this broad range of partners that's one of the reasons HIA is beginning to take hold. The synergy from this set of partners and stakeholders involved in HIA practice and field building efforts in Minnesota is adding to more than the sum of just single HIAs. And what we're seeing now is not just a handful of HIA projects completed, but really a groundswell of interest in incorporating health in decision making. And we have this larger set of examples to draw from, but there's also this, I think, underlying energy that's really driving those projects as well. I think the other thing to say is that demand for HIA is coming from not only local and state government, but also from community-based organizations, nonprofit organizations. And so those groups are seeing the value in their and connection to their work in different ways. Kristen will also be talking about how this work is now being coordinated, and HIA practitioners are convening and sharing practice and lessons learned across the state. This next slide, steps and elements of institutionalization. So this is kind of transitioning into talking about where you go after you have trained and built capacity to do HIA. And I think what's happening in Minnesota is also reflective in the field. We're now looking beyond, I think HIA practitioners are looking at beyond how to just do a single HIA. And we're looking at strategies beyond building on training and capacity efforts to embed considerations of health in decision making. So in doing so, I think it's helpful just to distinguish between capacity to do HIA through trainings and courses, but also then along the way, making sure that we're demonstrating the value after we've done those individual projects to make the case for it and hopefully increase demand that way as well. Alongside that, we're thinking about tools to consider and assess health, like checklists, models, and toolkits that can both help do the health impact assessment work, but also adapt that framework where it might not be necessary to do a full health impact assessment. And then, you know, also moving beyond capacity building, HIA practitioners are thinking about the structures and systems like changing job descriptions, creating formalized collaborations, or having screening protocol or legislation that mandates or supports HIA. So this shift was reflected in our latest round of funding at the Health Impact Project, in that we moved from funding just single HIA demonstration projects to what we are calling HIA programs, to look at how to help grantees develop partnerships and systems and funding strategies to do this on a more routine basis. And through funding from RWJF, Minnesota Department of Health was one of seven grantees to do this work. I think we're still learning what's going to work well, and we'll be continuing to look for what's working, how people are doing it, what's not working, and sharing those lessons about what really contributes to a self-supporting or sustainable HIA program. These seven grantees are part of a learning community and have a peer-to-peer forum for grantees to share what's working along the way, and then capturing those lessons learned and best practices through a report that will come out in early 2015. And that'll synthesize their barriers, their promising practices, and also survey the various models out there for building a sustainable HIA practice. So I think what's neat about this is that we have feedback happening in a lot of directions. The Minnesota work at the state level will feed into the national report summarizing those lessons learned, and then be put back out to regions and other states wanting to do this work. So just looking ahead, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think that in Minnesota, you know, there will be a continuation of capacity building efforts, particularly to those groups that have been a little bit more difficult to reach, small nonprofit groups, tribal entities, and non-health partners. It's easier to get health folks in the room and explain why this connects to their work, but I think we still need to look at the strategies to address how to reach planning, education, a whole range of other sectors. To the point about making sure we're making the case to the decision makers and the public, evaluating the impacts of the completed HIAs in the state, and also looking to broaden the application of HIA outside of those built environment, land use, and transportation sectors to demonstrate the value of HIA to other sectors like education and criminal justice. Human Impact Partners and Isaiah have a few examples they'll be talking about a little later on. And then outside of Minnesota, I would say that we'll be adapting that training and funding model for capacity building in other states. We've already started to do that with the other four funders that I mentioned. But I think that especially where practice is new, on those, I think it's the blue part of the map that was up there, how to start from that training and education and then move along that spectrum of institutionalization, for lack of a better word. And then again, making sure that we're capturing the lessons learned and best practices from Minnesota and other states that are building HIA program-like capacity as we move forward beyond single HIA practice. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to, there's my contact information. And I just before I do turn it over to Kristen, I'll say that if you are not already on our mailing list, that's the best way to learn about future funding opportunities. We don't have one out now, but that's the place to go to learn about it when we do. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kristen Robb to talk more about work from the Minnesota Department of Health.
All right, welcome everyone. Again, my name is Kristen Robb. I'm the program director for the Minnesota Climate and Health Program, and it is a pleasure to be speaking with you today. Thank you for coming to the session. I want to thank Bethany for organizing us and also for giving us the perspective of Minnesota's development from the funder perspective. I'm going to now provide it from the state perspective. And you'll see a lot of overlap, but there are some differences, so I think that's actually very interesting, and I think that there's a lot that we can learn from our different perspectives. So I have been fortunate enough to have been at the health department when we began our work in health impact assessments in 2009. So I've really been able to see the progress and the development of HIAs in Minnesota and in the health department. I have no finance relationships to disclose. I'm going to begin talking about the history of HIA in Minnesota. It does explain some of the things that Bethany was talking about today. And then I'm going to move into talking a little bit more specifically about our HIA program and how we're hoping to expand that out really to the state level, and then talk about our next steps in the possible future of HIA in Minnesota. So this is a diagram of the history of HIAs in Minnesota, and it really talks a lot about our development as a state and health impact assessments. And it began in 2006 with Design for Health, which is based at the University of Minnesota but has collaborators at Cornell University and the University of Colorado. Design for Health was funded by Blue Cross Blue Shield Center for Prevention to really explore the relationship between the built environment, design, and health. So they developed several tools and guidelines for performing HIAs, and they were really primarily based around comprehensive planning and land use. Since then, they used those tools, and then they assisted 19 cities and counties, and including health and comprehensive plans, transportation plans, bicycle plans, and other guidelines and ordinances. So since that time, there have been, as Bethany already mentioned, 18 HIAs that have either been performed or are being performed right now in Minnesota. And given Minnesota's history, really starting with land use in the built environment, it's not surprising that almost all of our HIAs have been on comprehensive plans, transportation plans, and land use plans. The one exception is the one that starred, which is the School Integration Strategy HIA Minnesota, and we will be having one of the panelists talk about that with you today, so that's very exciting. The other thing that I think is also exciting about the history is not only do we have 9 years of experience now with HIAs, we've also had organizations that have been dedicated to promoting HIA at the state level through legislation. So ISAIA, which is represented here today, the Minnesota Public Health Association, and the Service Employees International Union came together to submit legislation, the Healthy Communities Act, to promote funding for community-based HIAs. That legislation was not passed, but I did hear that lots of people were very excited about it. So we do have a history of starting to look at institutionalizing HIAs in Minnesota. I also really believe that Minnesota is at the cusp of significant breakthrough in either institutionalizing HIAs through legislative action or state-level policy change, and also potentially accelerating the use of HIAs in Minnesota. And I think that's for two main reasons. First of all, we've had many actors that have provided continuous leadership and capacity building in Minnesota. This is a slide that lists several of those main players. I think of particular importance has actually been the funders. Minnesota has been really fortunate to have had a variety of funders at the national level, at the state level, and through organizations to promote HIAs. Human capital exists everywhere, but without funding, it is really challenging to do HIAs. I think funding is a primary barrier to performing HIAs. So we've been very, very fortunate to have had such dedicated funding in Minnesota. Also, and secondly, I think that although HIA isn't a household name yet, it is very popular. Many people have heard of HIAs, and I think we've really reached a critical mass of people who are interested in HIAs. Either they've heard about it through the media, they've gone through training, or they've even been involved in an HIA. So I think that we're really at this critical point because of all these partners and players we've had at Minnesota. So we've just been really lucky that way. Now I'd just like to talk a little bit about the development of the MDH program. And again, I have started with funding because that's really been key to our development. And we've been lucky enough to have sustained funding. We've gotten a little creative in periods where there's been a little bit of a gap, but in general, we've had sustained funding. Our first grant came from the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 2009. And that basically initiated three trainings in Minnesota, and it also allowed us to perform three HIAs. So those were the first trainings and the first HIAs that we were able to do. In 2010, we received a grant from CDC to work on climate change, but we could also do health impact assessments as long as they supported our climate change work. So with that grant, we were able to do one HIA, and we moved into health and all policies, which I'll talk about in a minute. Recently, we received two grants, one from ASTO and CDC, again, to do peer mentorship, and we mentored two states, Delaware and Georgia, and then we also received the Health Impact Project Grant, which is our program grant, which is going to sustain our work to 2015. And it's really this program grant that I think is really going to push us off into a new level. We've also been fortunate in that we did receive legislative funding, not specifically for this program, but to work specifically with vulnerable populations and air pollution. This was a joint project with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and MDH, and it's to develop a community toolkit to look at specifically air pollution issues. And one of the tools within that toolkit is to perform HIAs. So we've been really lucky to have kind of a variety of funding, and I'm hoping we'll be able to build more on this. So I think there are really six key roles in promoting a sustainable program for HIAs. And the Health Department has been involved in about five of those six key roles. The first is really the ability to perform HIAs or actually performing HIAs. This is really critical to staying current with the latest and greatest tools and methodology in HIA, and it fosters continuous learning. Every HIA is different, so it's really important that as you're building your program, you're staying in the game and you're continuing to do HIAs. Second, I think it's really important to provide technical assistance and training. Technical assistance is important to improve the quality of HIAs. I think it's been really important in the HIAs that have been performed in Minnesota. Almost all of them have had technical assistance. And training is really important as a precursor to performing HIAs, as well as making sure that there is a continuous stream of practitioners that are ready to perform HIAs. So we have led or performed five HIAs in Minnesota. We've also provided technical assistance to five other HIAs, and we've provided nine HIA trainings. In the beginning, I think I already mentioned that we contracted with Design for Health to do our first three trainings. But after we had gone through those trainings, we had done our own health impact assessments, we were able to develop our own training. And since then, we have performed another six trainings in Minnesota. So our trainings have reached over 200 people and 70 organizations. And as Bethany already mentioned, we're not the only people doing training in Minnesota. The Health Impact Project with Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation has supported a lot of other trainings in Minnesota, so we've really reached a lot of people through training. A third key component of a sustainable HIA program is really policy development, and there's really two parts to this. First, promoting HIAs by institutionalizing HIAs, and then also by promoting health in all policies, which I think is very important to the future of HIAs. Performing a one-off HIA is really great to make connections between the policy and health and to support community engagement. I think that's been shown by Isaiah. But it isn't very efficient to making lasting population-based changes. So I think we're really interested in promoting HIAs, but we're really interested in eventually moving to health in all policies. A fourth key role is data and tool development. There are a lot of questions when you're going through HIAs regarding certain health impacts. And right now, we don't have a lot of data sources to answer those questions. Plus, many of the data sources are not available at the level that's useful for the community, which I'm sure many of you have found. And I think tool development is also important because it helps HIA practitioners ask different questions that they may not ask. It also provides guidance to their work, and it can also help streamline HIAs. And fifth, I think another important and very key role, especially for the future in Minnesota, is the role of a collaborator, convener, and centralized information distributor. The health department has worked in all of these roles except the final role, which is funding. And that is a key role that we need to be working on in the future. But as far as the other roles, we have worked on institutionalizing HIAs through looking at the environmental review process. Specifically, we did some research on the environmental assessment worksheet, which is one of the main worksheets that proposers of land use projects have to go through in order to get approval and permitting. We made recommendations to the Environmental Quality Board to promote changes in the environmental assessment worksheet to include health and climate change. We also worked within the Seven County metro area and their comprehensive planning process through the Metropolitan Council. And what we did there was we reviewed 57 comprehensive plans, found out whether or not they were considering certain health and climate change indicators, and then based some recommendations that we provided to the Metropolitan Council. And hopefully they will be making some changes to their comprehensive planning processes. So we have been starting to look at how to promote health in all policies. We've also been working on tool development. We have some training on incorporating health into the environmental assessment worksheet. We have trainings and a how-to guide on looking at health and climate change in comprehensive planning. And we will be working on tool development around brownfields and climate change. We also have a website, which is listed right there, that has all of our documents, all of our tools, all of our trainings on it. So if you want to see anything that we've done, you can go to our website. We also support a listserv where we almost have 300 people on that listserv where we send out the latest and greatest on health impact assessments. And I think most importantly, we're really trying to work on collaborating and building collaboration through two key groups, which I will talk about in just a minute, and I only have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to speed it up, which is, so we have this Health Impact Project grant, and we have many deliverables that support some of those key goals. We're going to be performing 3 HIAs, 6 trainings in total. We've already done one. We have another one scheduled for December. We're going to be working on the HIA climate change tool and training, and then HIA brownfield tool. And then we will be looking at that funding component, which is to develop a sustainability financial plan. And then most importantly, we're really going to be working on developing the Minnesota HIA Coalition and the HIA Interagency Workgroup. And so I'm going to just describe the HIA Interagency Workgroup. This is a group of state agencies that are bringing coming together to champion HIAs in Minnesota. Right now we have 9 state agencies, including the Department of Education, which is not on here because they just recently joined. And we're really hoping that this group can identify places and projects to promote HIAs and also health and all policies. We're hoping to establish some memos of understanding and develop a strategic plan on how we can promote HIAs at the state level. We separated the interagency work group from the coalition because government agencies have certain constraints because they work under the governor, and as different people are elected, intergovernment priorities change. So we thought it was really important. They also have other strengths. They do a lot. For example, our Minnesota Department of Transportation has a lot of funding available for large projects like transportation projects, and those types of projects could be used to promote health. So they have strengths and they have weaknesses, and we thought it was best to really separate the two groups. And then the other group that I mentioned is the Minnesota HIA Coalition. This is 62 members and counting. This consists of nonprofit, educational institutions, state, local agencies, community organizations, universities that are coming together to promote HIAs. We had our first meeting in August, and they were tremendously enthusiastic. They came up with the following goals, which I'm not going to read to you, but they're really, really excited promoting HIAs. We're going to have some challenges ahead, and most importantly is really making this group independent to lead HIAs in the future. We're facilitating this group for now, but we really see this as being an independent organization. So the key next steps really is to determine that funding. Some of those strategies is looking at fundraising, looking at legislation, looking at fee-for-services, partnering with other agencies, making sure that we're continuing to provide technical assistance and training. And these are really the future roles, which I've already elaborated on. But the one that's missing here is the collaboration piece. And that's really the glue in the middle that's going to keep this all together. So I apologize. I'm sort of running out of time. So thank you. And I look forward to your questions.
We're going to zoom ahead and then zoom back. Oh, John.
Oh, they were in the right order.
I think so. You want to, should I zoom back?
Yes, zoom back. Yes, I'm going first.
Never mind, we're zooming all over the place. Fine. There we go.
Thank you. All right, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you again for coming, and thank you, Bethany, for inviting us to be part of this session. I'm Jonathan Heller, and I'm the co-director of Human Impact Partners. We're a nonprofit in California based in Oakland. We work to try and transform the policies and places people need to live healthy lives, and we do that by increasing the consideration of health and equity in decision-making. We have been around for 6 or 7 years now, and have been involved in trying to build capacity around the country for health impact assessment, and it's actually fantastic to see how much things in Minnesota have moved forward. It's amazing. In Minnesota specifically, we've done a couple trainings and done one HIA that I'm going to talk about. This is kind of a shift. I'm going to dive down into one particular HIA. It's I guess the oddball HIA in the state, the one that was not on built environment issues. We've also supported some other projects in the state through technical assistance as well. Where I'd start with is this was an HIA that was called for, asked for by the community. And I just want to put in a plug for something Doran is going to talk quite a bit more about. But I think one other key ingredient of institutionalizing HIA and in an effective way is to make sure that the community is actually demanding it and calling for it. And one of the reasons for that is that two of the core values of HIA are equity and democracy. And I think that unless the community is heavily involved, I think those two values can often be either go by the wayside completely or certainly be reduced. And we can work on a lot of issues that don't actually get at the core equity issues that HIA, I think, is meant to address. And when we do work with the community, and the community is asking for this kind of work, they can hold us accountable to really answering to equity, about equity, and we can work with them to build power among the populations that are being impacted by these decisions, and I think that's really the way we're going to get long-standing change that is really more equitable. So the focus is an HIA that we conducted with ISAIAH, with Doran's organization, on school integration strategies in Minnesota, and I'll describe the context in a second. We have no relationships to disclose. So the context for this is that racial segregation in schools is persisting, in fact, it's getting worse, and this is true in Minnesota, and it's true in many other places around the country. And there are lots and lots of strong feelings going way back about integration in schools. Things have progressed quite a bit since busing and all the fights around busing, including here in Boston, but there are still lots of strong feelings about it. Minnesota has historically valued and made a lot of progress towards integration, but the current, what it's called the CHOICE program, and the integration funding have actually not moved us forward on this front. And one of the ways that's actually been embodied is that the question is who's making the choices in these education programs? Who's able to move their children from one school to another? So the idea behind this is that parents can choose to take their kids away from their neighborhood school and move them to a better performing school. And what we've seen in Minnesota and in other places is the parents who have the capacity to do that, to make those decisions, to do the research, to drive their kids out of district to a different school, are not the kids that are in most need of help. And the kids that get left behind are typically the African-American kids, kids of color, and they're left in even poorer schools often. And so these CHOICE programs really haven't been effective. So with that recognition, and recognition that the integration funding has been used for a variety, not always the best purposes in the state, a state task force came together in 2012 to develop a set of recommendations to improve integration funding mechanisms. That was turned into legislation in 2013, right in January, which is when the HIA started. The reason we really got involved in this is that we've partnered with ISAIAH in the past, and both their education and health committees were interested in this and interested in working together on this. They saw education as a health issue, as a social determinant of health. So this is a very, very challenging HIA in a lot of ways. We were trying to fit this in within the legislative timeline. And so we only had a few months to actually do the complete HIA from start to finish. And as you've heard, most of the HIAs that have been done out there have been done on land use. And so the body of evidence that we had and everything else was pretty rudimentary at the beginning of this project. Usually in an HIA that's rapid, the first thing to go is community engagement. Right? We don't have time. We don't have resources. Let's drop the community engagement and we'll just do it on our own. And that's exactly what we did not want to do. And that's against the spirit of the way we do HIA and would very much be against the way ISAIAH works as well. So we had to fit it in quickly. And so this is an overview of a methodology that we've now developed and tried out three or four different times to get something done on a rapid time scale with community involvement. And so we started talking to ISAIAH about this back in September of 2012, a year ago. And they were interested in this, and at that point we basically were screening and we put in a proposal to the Health Impact Project, which a few months later in January notified us that we got the grant. The bill was introduced in January as well, so we went into the whole thing expecting a bill to be introduced but not totally certain that it would be. It was, and so we hit the ground running in January as soon as things started. ISAIAH's job in January was to pull together a stakeholder panel that I'll talk a little bit more about on the next page, that stakeholder panel really made all the decisions about the HIA and led the whole project. We had our first meeting of the stakeholder panel on February 2nd, and that was really a meeting to describe what HIA was and give some background to talk about the actual integration bill that was being considered now in the legislature, and to focus them on telling us what we should study for them. What were their concerns? What were their interests? How did they think school integration linked to health outcomes? And so we came away focusing on two different pathways that I'll talk more about, but one was about educational achievement and the other was about cross-race connection and the health benefits of both of those things. After February 2nd, we went away for about 5 or 6 weeks. We did our research like mad. We put a bunch of people on the project. We did lit reviews. We looked at existing conditions. We drafted an initial report, all in preparation for a second meeting, 2-day meeting, with the same panel of stakeholders that happened on March 15th and 16th. During that meeting, we presented our findings from the literature, about our findings from existing conditions data. We had 3 subject matter experts come and kind of testify to this group about what their perspectives on the connections between integration and health were, and the state of integration in Minnesota. And based on all that information, this panel then had a lot of discussions, a lot of heated discussions about integration and what would be the impacts of this bill. It was an amazing process, I have to say. We facilitated them coming to understanding amongst each other about what this would look like and what were the problems with integration in schools in general. During those 2 days, they came to consensus about what they would predict the impacts to be of the bill. And they came to consensus on a set of recommendations that they would want to make. We took that and went away, revised the report based on everything we heard, put in the impacts, put in the recommendations, had subsequent phone calls to make sure everybody was on board with everything, and released the HIA on April 15th in time to make a difference in the legislative session. And that was the final goal. So that's the way this process worked. The panel that was so instrumental in this was composed of a bunch of different kinds of people. Some of the folks on the panel were Isaiah members. Many of them were not. They were people who Isaiah was interested in building better relationships with, for example. There were teachers, school district administrators, a school board member. There were parents, academic researchers, racial justice advocates, and one of the members of the statewide school integration task force that I mentioned that was working together in 2012. And through this process, I would say that all of these folks built stronger connections and relationships to one another, and same with Isaiah. They built their relationships as well. This panel came from many different perspectives, and we had a lot of really deep conversations, and I learned a lot just watching it and listening to it and trying to facilitate it all, which was not easy a lot of the time. We spanned a lot of different topics, including things like critical race theory and, just what does school achievement mean, how do we measure it, what's the differences between black and white communities in the state and their perceptions. So it was really good. They came up with a set of goals that included these things: defining integration. So integration isn't just putting different colored kids in the same school together, right? It's more about educational equity, and that's an important distinction. So they defined integration through this process. They wanted to describe the current state of school integration, disseminate recommendations, inform the legislature, use the political opportunity that we were handed basically to talk about root causes of racism and the drivers of segregation, to unmask for policymakers how inequity is continued through public policy, and to explore the non-educational attainment benefits of integration. On that last one, I'm going to show you 2 slides that are essentially the pathway diagram that we came up with, that they came up with, which starts with the recommendations that got made into legislation. If those are going to get implemented, that would change school integration. There are a whole other set of factors that actually are hugely important for determining whether we achieve better educational outcomes for all of our students and whether we achieve educational equity that are listed up at the top. But school integration, the hypothesis was that, and what everybody was talking about out there, was that it would be good for school achievement. And that was the reason to do it, that we would improve educational outcomes. And that's kind of that top row in the pathway diagram. And we did a bunch of research, and that is true. We'll talk about that more. But what people really want to explore even more than that were the things more in the middle there, that school integration would lead to changes in interactions in the classroom, and that would lead to better cross-racial connections. And they believed that there was something there, and we had to go find that and see whether that was true in the literature, essentially. And then the last row, interestingly, was that they thought that there may be changes in the community, in interactions in the community. If you send your kid out of district to schools, does that impact community cohesion, for example. And we actually had, there was no literature on that, and so we ended up not pursuing that at all. But, you know, this goes on to bring it out to all the health outcomes. So there's the educational achievement piece up top, which we really just stole from Robert Wood Johnson's. They have a brief on education and health, and so that it's, it lays it out beautifully there. The stuff at the bottom we had to do a lot more research on, and that's a cross-racial connection and how that links to mental health, social health, emotional health, changes in crime, things like that. So just to recap that, we looked at educational achievement and income and employment, a bunch of indicators related to that, the middle section on cross-racial connection, stress and mental health, education and crime. And then the other thing that was really important is that we needed to look at contemporary integration strategies. We were moving beyond busing, clearly. What does this mean in today's world to really integrate our schools? So some of the things we found. Children of color who attend integrated schools tend to have higher income in it as adults, and that has all sorts of health implications, really good health implications. The effects of education on health are passed down through generations, so if a parent is better educated, that leads to a better, healthier environment for their children, and that's important. Third, the social consequences of low educational attainment include all sorts of things related to workforce productivity and economic growth, having a skilled workforce, and crime, all of which have societal impact. So it's about more than just the students themselves and their families, but it actually has society-wide impacts. And the last, and I think this was the most important piece for that was new, super new for this conversation, was that a comprehensive approach to integration leads to cross-racial connections in classrooms, which lowers levels of prejudice in children, adolescents, and adults. That leads to better improved in mental health for people of color who are not facing as much racism in society. And importantly, it has benefits for white folks as well, greater comfort in future multiracial settings, for example, in work settings and in civil society, and that has tremendous benefits as well. So we summarized all of that in one table that lists a lot of those health outcomes up above, and then we scored different things that could happen with the bill that had been introduced according to whether they would benefit these things or not. If the bill did not pass, we said that would be really bad for health. That would be bad for health for all sorts of reasons that we talked about. If it passed as it was introduced, it would be okay. It wasn't great. There were problems with the bill as it had been introduced, and it could be improved on. We recommended, as I'll talk about in a second, a bunch of amendments, and if you actually pass it with those amendments, things would get better. And if you passed it with those amendments and put in place a whole host of other things to get to educational equity, then that would actually lead to really positive health outcomes. So those were our findings. And we made a whole set of recommendations to the Minnesota legislature and the governor, to the Department of Education, and to school districts and communities. So, for example, we said, fund the bill, do it, pass it, make educational equity the central goal of it, define integration holistically, amend the bill so that it would measure integration in a better way. The way the bill had really defined it is that schools could default to just saying, we're making progress on educational achievement, and therefore we're satisfying the bill. And we said, that's not okay. We need to do better than that. Integration isn't only about educational achievement. We suggested to the Department of Education that they should change the desegregation rule, increase the staffing in the integration department beyond the one person that they had there, convene a panel of state and national experts to support these integration plans, and then we made a whole bunch of recommendations to individual schools and districts. Just to move through the last couple slides quickly, we released the bill or the HIA on April 15th. We got a letter. Isaiah got a letter back from the author of the bill saying that they were very happy it had been done. That the author takes a holistic view to public policy development. One of their goals is to produce an overall healthier and stronger society, and they saw the HIA as helping to contribute to that. They thought the HIA ties together policy objectives and knowledge from different public areas of public life, and so it was nice to see appreciation from people in the legislature. We got a great article in the Min Post the following day as well, that quoted the HIA extensively and really brought attention to the kinds of issues we wanted to bring attention to. Some really good outcomes out of the whole thing. So the program was passed as part of the 2013 budget. The language was modified following some of our suggestions, so the accountability mechanisms were made stronger even than we had recommended in the HIA. We didn't win everything. They didn't take a kind of more holistic definition of integration into account, so not perfect. We hear, and the Commissioner of Health is in the room, so we can verify this, that the Commissioner of Education reached out and said we should start talking about health and all policies. It sounds like those conversations were going on already. This hopefully just contributed to the groundswell towards that. And then last we heard in the last couple of weeks that the Department of Education has convened a group to discuss changes to this desegregation rule, which is a key piece of how integration happens in the state, and some of the ISAIA members are now participating in that. So all good outcomes. That is my contact information, and the HIA is available on our website as well. Okay.
Can I just push this button?
Yep. Hello, my name is Doran Schrantz. I am the Executive Director of ISAIA. I'm very happy to be here with you today, and thanks to Bethany again for organizing this panel. So what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to give you a little more introduction to ISAIA and who we are. I want to introduce to you some of the concepts of community-based organizing and how that work has been at the center of the HIAs that we have done. And then talk a little bit about the lessons and outcomes of we've learned from doing what we would describe as community-led HIAs. And hopefully that will open up some dialogue. So, community organizing HIAs. I have no relationships to disclose. This whole thing was new for me, so I really don't think I do. So what is ISAIA? ISAIA is a faith-based community organizing organization of 100 member congregations in the metropolitan area and St. Cloud, which is a small town about 90 miles north of the Twin Cities. And our mission is that we are a vehicle for congregations and people of faith to work effectively and collectively for racial, economic, and social justice. Our strategies to meet our mission are we are deeply values-based and we're rooted in our faith. So there's lots of different ways that people can enter into a public conversation with different identities. So you can come into the conversation as a racial justice advocate or as a citizen or as a public official. And our people, when they come into the public arena through our organization, are entering the conversation from their identity as being a person of faith grounded in a set of values. We do utilize the methodologies of grassroots community-based organizing, and we move people collectively as we do that training and development of people to move into effective public action in the public arena around our mission. So we're seeking to have concrete impact. It's not just to have values and name them or, you know, talk about them, but to really pick places where we feel we can have concrete impact in the public arena. So, what is community organizing? This is my definition, and others may disagree in the field, but this is my best shot at it. Community organizing is a set of disciplined, strategic practices to build democratic and collective power to assure the conditions in which a community or communities can thrive. And we do that through A, leadership development. So what that means is a huge part of our resources are going into developing the capacity of people to act powerfully and effectively in the public arena with each other. That's a set of skills, it's a way of thinking, it's a set of struggles, it's a lot of investment in people to be powerful leaders in the public arena. And we also do this by building both our own and then assisting the capacity building of other organizations to build democratic, accountable, sustainable, community-driven organization. So it's one thing for people to be an activist as an individual. It's another thing for people to be connected to one another in a vehicle that's a people's vehicle to have impact in the world. And that's a really important distinction to understand, particularly when you're talking about community engagement. what kinds of organizations are member-driven, democratic power organizations that are vehicles for people to have collective action together, and what are more loose affiliations or individual activism. And then lastly, our theory of change inside this model is it says that power, or the ability to act, is one of the essential missing ingredients for people to thrive. So we can say a lot of different things impact, make things inequitable. But one of it is that communities that experience the most impact of, or not having impact on the things that they need to have impact on, one of the missing ingredients is, do they have enough power? So our organization has conducted, in partnership, two HIAs. The first one was the Healthy Corridor for All. We did that in partnership with PolicyLink. Victor Rubin is here. And Take Action Minnesota Hmong Organizing Program were the core organizations, partner organizations at the center. But then we built a 22-member community-led steering committee that drove that HIA and a technical panel, a technical assistance panel, to support it. And the project we were looking at was the zoning plan, or the land use plan, around the building of a light rail through the city of St. Paul, which went through some of the most diverse and under-resourced communities in our region. And the second HIA you just heard about was the Rapid School Integration HIA. So just briefly, I won't go into the details of this, but the Healthy Corridor for All HIA, we assess the impacts of the light rail zoning plan on health. We wanted to maximize the potential of that zoning plan to create health inequity, and really importantly, a huge goal for us was to build the capacity of the Community Steering Committee to advocate for the vision for their communities. So even at the end of the HIA, or whatever that process was, were we ending up with more capacity for people to drive, because there's going to be 10 years of decision making around that project, for there to be more capacity left behind. The outcomes of that were, we had a whole series of recommendations. I'm not doing a presentation on that HIA, but the outcomes were, we worked a lot on housing. We found out through the work that people were very housing insecure, and there was a large concern of gentrification. Property values were already going up with the investment of the light rail corridor. So over a long, long process, we had recommended a set of recommendations, and we ended up with an anti-displacement and affordable housing plan that the city passed that dedicated $1.2 million to the preservation and protection of affordable housing. Just update, we are now moving forward density bonuses, which would basically ensure that there is more affordable housing as projects are built, to incentivize developers to do more affordable housing. And we have a permanent affordable housing table with stakeholders from across the city in place to put together a strategic plan for affordable housing. You heard about the rapid school integration. I won't go into that. So here's the main point. Our goal in doing HIAs, we're not a public health department, we're not really in the public health field formally or officially, so the question is why would you want to do HIAs as a community-based, community organizing organization? And were actually, as Isaiah, she had the Healthy Communities Act up there, we had begun to explore the possibility of HIAs potentially being a very powerful tool for bringing a different set of values into public decision making. And when you're engaged in organizing, a lot of what you're up against is sets of narratives and stakeholders that put other values that are the priorities around public decision making, often economic, return on investment. I mean, these things are important. But how could we actually have a different framework and values with the power backing it up to counterbalance what is the dominant priorities of a lot of public decision making? And we felt that health impact assessments actually offered a very concrete, practical tool to do that, and we wanted to explore it. But we wanted to do this in a way also that was community grounded, so that it was, even as we were doing the process, it wasn't going to end up being a report sitting on a shelf someplace or a nice process, but could you do it in such a way that you were actually building the power of the community through the process so that they would have more ability to ensure that the recommendations were implemented. That's the theory. So from the beginning, we wanted to be sure that we asked sets of questions, both from our technical partners and our who were actually helping us do the technical process of the HIA, but then also technical stakeholders who are a part of it, such as government officials or people from the university. We wanted to be sure that the question, who is at the center of this process, was answered. The question, who owns the process? So whose interests are being met? Who is deciding what the priorities are? What's going to be studied and what's not going to be studied? What's important and what's deemed not important? And so who's at the center of answering those questions often determines, it's like your little flow chart, right? It'll determine how it plays out. So sometimes what happens is that the things that are closest to the center of the priorities of a community, ultimately, if they're not at the center of the process, ultimately not what's at the center of either an HIA or any other decision-making or planning process. So we wanted to put formally the impacted communities and community organizations at the center of making all of these decisions. So it's not just that they were informing or that they were doing a survey. They made these decisions. And in both of these processes, we structured the center of the process to accomplish this. So the Community Steering Committee of 22 members with PolicyLink actually decided what indicators were going to be looked at. They prioritized what it is that we were going to look at. They picked 42 indicators. Shireen Malik-Fazali from PolicyLink about passed out when they did that. But they made decisions about how to prioritize what we were going to really look at or what we weren't. So that really shaped both of what happened with the HIA, what was studied and what the recommendations were, but then it also shaped the level of ownership and capacity to push through the recommendations when the time came to do that. So I really like this phrase. One of our partners is Tony Eitan. We learned a lot from him early in our days of thinking about health equity, and we wanted to structure our HIAs around this theory of change, which is that it's powerlessness that is making us sick, and so we have to build power. So again, why HIA? I've had a lot of people in the public health community ask me that. If you're interested in community organizing and advocacy, why HIA? I think in both cases, with the school integration HIA and the Healthy Corridor for All, we showed that HIA actually is a powerful tool for shifting the public debate. So the public debate in the beginning of the Central Corridor was the business impacts, which were very important, but they tended to be larger scale business impacts. We were able to bring health and equity into the conversation as priorities, and then to have the scientific research and technical support of the public health departments, of PolicyLink, of the university to say, this is real research and these are real impacts. So it lent credibility to the things that the community on some level already knew, but it lends a public credibility and legitimacy to those claims. It ensured that community priorities, interests, and values were heard and acted on, and it aligned interests. So the other thing that an HIA can do is bring stakeholders to a table who actually may be in tension with one another. I think that was very much demonstrated in the school integration HIA that we did. So a lot of the education field, as many of you know, has a set of very intense fault lines that are directly around the question of race. And people have a history and experience of integration from the past and a whole set of conflicting narratives and experiences around that word. It's politicized, it's polarizing, and people are in camps. So a lot of what would stop the public education debate in our state capital was really those camps not being able to come to a common consensus, which really would create a policy work going backwards instead of forwards. So the process of building the stakeholder table was incredibly important. I could go through a lot of examples of how that went out. A good example is Phyllis Hill, who is on our staff, who led this process for our staff. So she made all these phone calls all around through the field, from racial justice advocates to African American leaders to people who think that they're absolutely against integration in the communities of color, for example, or people who are for charter schools, against public schools, all then said, this thing that we're going to do is not what you think it is. She said you had to first start by telling everybody this is what it's not. It is not a way, a red wagon for us to like push forward an integration strategy that's going to hurt your kids. That's not what this is. We're going to have an honest discussion about what integration means. And through that process, we were really able to bring together people who haven't been in the room together, or the last time they were in the room together, they had a fight. So this created a little political space where people could come to some common understanding, some common goals, really hear each other, and then advance something together at the state capitol, which was a very powerful, powerful experience. So another of these bullets, the one I want to lift up, is equity at the center. So this, in my some dealings in the conversations about HIA or in the field, there's some debate about this. Should equity be at the center of the process? Is that even make it biased? Where does objectivity live? Do we talk about race when we're actually doing our HIAs? And in our experience, we decided very intentionally to put not only equity at the center, but conversations about race and racial equity. And in both cases, that is actually the thing that allowed us to move forward and struggle with the things that needed to be struggled with and bring people together who have all kinds of embedded tensions over years of work. The fact that we are willing to put race and racial justice at the center of the conversations is what allowed it to move forward. So I just wanted to name that. It's a thing that requires some courage but is really important. So here's some of the challenges in doing HIA this way as we've done it. So one is the objectivity debate. It is really important that the HIA have the technical process have a lot of integrity to it, that the research is objective, that it's technically done well and it's done right, that the science is sound. All of that is incredibly important. It's also incredibly important for the HIA to be powerful that there are stakeholders at the center who are going to move an advocacy process. And by advocacy process, what I mean is launching a strategy, doing a power analysis, figuring out what the problems are going to be, operating in a political moment. So sometimes that technical process and that political process are in tension. And the way that you navigate that tension is important. It has to be negotiated every step of the way, so that you both protect the integrity of the science and all that, and the integrity of the process, but also you don't miss your political moment. So the other tension point is the role of controversy and friction. So if you're going to do an HIA around something that is really important to people, it will most likely be controversial. It means it actually is something that is really, really unfolding in the political and public debate, and people are on different sides, and there's a controversy. So this is a tool that can come in and not smooth over the controversy. It can shift the public debate and political climate around that controversy, but we can't shy away from controversy because change process has friction and controversy embedded in it. That's the nature of change. So the political process can often be in tension with HIA. I think it's important to name that there's sometimes a culture clash. So a professional culture and of people who are in the public health field, people who are in the university field, people who are in the academic field, with a community-grounded culture can sometimes be like, phew. So that is something that you actually have to build in process and conversation to figure out what people mean by language, translate, be really clear in communication. And then lastly, there is something to really consider about resources and capacity. So Jonathan said sometimes when the resources are short, we like cut off the community engagement process. Community engagement takes resource, community engagement. Community organizing, giving communities the power and resources they need to organize a process like this takes resources. And I would argue the more we're putting resources overtly into the hands of communities to be able to lead these kinds of processes, the more the work is actually going to be sustainable over time, because those advocates and leaders will continue to advocate for their health. They will continue to be owners and leaders for health in their communities. And so that is something that we need to think about together. And lastly, a lot of these tensions that I'm describing, one way that you can not get over them, but potentially understand more clearly, what different stakeholders are thinking is really overtly talking about your theory of change. So I started this presentation by overtly telling you our theory of change and how we do the work is that community organizing builds the power for communities to long-term advocate for the things that they need to make their lives work for them. And that one of the missing ingredients is power, and that's where we're coming from. So when we can talk overtly about about our theory of change, we can come to greater understanding of how to work together. Thank you.
Thank you. We could just give another round of applause for our panelists. Great job. We have about, 12 minutes for questions and discussion. Does anyone have any questions? Sure. Sure. So I imagine each of us might have a thought on this, some of us. I think that screening is really important, and HIA is one tool of many to include health in decision making, and oftentimes HIA may not be the right tool to meet your objectives. I think we're seeing more and more examples of ways to adapt the framework in places where maybe you already have built those relationships and partnerships and can get to your specific objectives using something like a toolkit or checklist. You know, I think there's some caution to impart there to make sure we're not losing the value in HI that comes from community and stakeholder engagement. But I think that that's a great question, and I think Kristen and Jonathan might want to add to it.
I think that's a great question. I think HIAs are an incredibly valuable tool, and I think Jeremy really talked a lot about how powerful HIAs can be, especially around community empowerment and equity issues. So they're definitely a critical tool, but I also think that, at least from the state level, I think it's important that we move towards health and all policies because we simply don't have the resources to do HIAs on everything, and they're not the right tool for everything. So it's kind of doing both. It's doing HIAs and it's doing health and all policies. And I do feel that, you know, upon listening to my colleagues here, it's really important that if we do pursue health and all policies and not doing a lot of HIAs, that we are considering it.
I agree. The only thing I'd add is where is the community in health and all policies? And that's, you know, the way it's been defined in many places. It's an interagency activity, which is great and it's needed, but where does the community live in that? And that's fundamental to it. I think that's fundamental to me in terms of it achieving equity.
Other questions? Go ahead.
I guess I'm wondering, just for the last presentation, the piece about the tension between the technical process and the political moment, and sort of navigating. I'm curious if you could say any more about what navigating that tension was like for the partners, whether there was more tension or certain of the partners involved in the HIA, or just sort of, I can imagine that. My understanding from experience is that potentially the biggest challenge in balancing having an actual impact and being able to do it each
day. Yeah, so one of the tensions can simply be time. And so a political decision is happening on a certain timeline, and sometimes the piece of paper tells you what the timeline is going to be or what's on the website. But then that's not really the timeline. So you can plan out, like, these are the stages of when we're going to So here's an example. In the Healthy Florida for All, we basically mapped out the five stages of the HIA, and we mapped underneath it an advocacy, an organizing process that's going along with it. So we wanted to, we released the baseline data. So even though it wasn't done in terms of the recommendations, we felt the baseline data in and of itself was agitational. So we mapped out those pieces based on like where the city council votes were going to be and when they were having what meetings. So sometimes it was simply time. Like it took, in order for the research to have integrity, it was going to take more time and resources. So we were in a push and pull all the time about like, well, like what's good enough so we can get it out, otherwise we're going to miss the moment. So I mean, that's a very concrete example of when there was tension. I mean, the other tension, which, I mean, the truth of the matter is both our technical partners, both PolicyLink and Human Impact Partners, were deeply supportive of the fact that the HIA was being used with a community empowerment model and supported that. There was around it people who began to try to discredit the HIA by, like, their political move to discredit it was, this is obviously a, you know, to discredit the science or to discredit its integrity. So some of what we had to do is defend it as we were going along so that it couldn't get dismissed because we were engaged in a political process. So those are two concrete examples.
Joe?
So just to follow up on that very point, did you find that transparency was effective means of defending that?
Well, transparency and the fact that it was wrong. So they were wrong that the HIA was not being well done. It was being incredibly well done. It was incredibly thorough. Both PolicyLink. The main place we got a text was actually the Healthy Florida for All policy. And the PolicyLink staff who were on it were so capable. And so then she actually was in town quite a bit, meeting with mayor staff, meeting with people, meeting with, and showing the data. But and it was hard to take her out. Look good.
I do think that there's this false dichotomy that's been created within the field of HIA where you can either do advocacy or you can have objective hard science. That's not the case, right? You can do both, and we can do both.
And your HIA was great.
It was great.
Go ahead.
I can certainly attest to everything that Doran has said. I was fortunate to be supervisor during all this and only made one or two of those trips. She probably made a dozen. But another way in which it was transparent, and this is perhaps an irony, but not an unimportant one, it didn't turn out to be terribly complicated health-related research. Most of it was about affordable housing. And if anything, a lot of the advocacy planners, urban planners, that is, who work on housing and economic development, if they do their job right, that's the analysis that needed to be done, and it wasn't being done by any of the numerous other parties. So the social determinants of health model and the community priorities led the HIA's technical work to be predominantly about economic development and employment, about housing, and about some very basic transportation issues like how would bus access change, what would be the net effect of the light rail access. So it wasn't epidemiological research. It was a kind of urban planning research with a focus on low-income communities that, as a planner, not a public health person, I would say needs to be done on any kind of project that way. But it was the health framework and the community empowerment strategy that made sure those issues got attended to at a point in the process where they were largely, honestly, not getting the attention they needed. And a lot of the pushback was not from conservative interest, it was from very liberal politicians who didn't like the fact that this was sort of showing up that they hadn't done everything that they might have done. And in the end, I should talk, that's just my editorial, I think Doran doesn't have that. but that's what it looked like. And so it wasn't rocket science in that respect, but it might have been the right tools for that job. And it might say more about urban planning as a profession than it does about public health, about what, because it rose those issues. In another situation,
thank you. We have about 2 minutes left. Can we go in the white jacket and then in the back?
Okay. And second, I guess when we do these projects, we start with where the community is. And so we don't go into Minnesota and say, wow, this is a great school integration bill, who wants to work on it? We say, community, what are you guys interested in? And that guarantees that we have a community partner that is totally and 100% behind us. And so we're working on the issues that they want to work on, not vice versa.
So it is true that, and I'm going to speak specifically for the field of community organizing, there's a lot of different community engagement models, and I cannot speak for all of them. So this is new. So working with data and research and sort of seeing it as another set of relationships and tools in your toolbox and how it actually connects to your mission, I think there's a lot of organizations that, there's some organizations moving forward seeing the opportunity that that could, and others it's harder to see. So, I mean, I just want to acknowledge, you're also, I mean, all fields are in various phases of evolution, and this is something that's a little out of the box for a lot of community organizing organizations. But I can certainly talk to you more about Kansas City if you want. And I do not have a tutorial.
No. I mean, the only two HIA-specific resources that might be worth mentioning are a guidance on promoting equity through the use of health impact assessment and best practices of stakeholder engagement for HIA. So that would be very HIA-specific, not specific to engaging faith-based organizations. Talk to her.
Yeah, we actually have written up a two-pager. We can give you your card. I'll send it to you, but we haven't actually released it publicly, so we'll have to send it to you.
Okay, so we are at 4 o'clock. Thank you very much for attending the session, and let's just give one more round of applause. Thank you.